The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Start 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to our Friday morning Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston. Great to be here. Thank you all for tuning in. One quick note, we're doing the one-hour format today. I know this is the start of the Labor Day weekend holiday for many of you, so this will be the one-hour format show. If you do have questions or comments for our guest, either call in or email. Don't wait until the last minute. Now, typically, you know that we don't have the Space Show going over holiday weekends, but we do have a program with Dr. Bill Rowe on this Sunday, 12 noon California time. That's August 31st with Dr. Bill Rowe. That program will be a typical regular Space Show program, but on Monday, September 1st, which is actually the Labor Day holiday itself, there is no Space Show, and we resume again on Tuesday evening after the holiday. So just wanted to give all of you that heads up. For those of you that are able to give us a call today, our toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. Remember, no call screeners. Please let the phone ring until it can be answered, and we'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. Email, of course, is drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. And then just a couple of other real quick announcements. We do podcast, and gigadial.net is our podcasting client, and you'll find the RSS subscription URL on both of our newsletters. It's also on our website, so if you have any questions about our podcast, don't hesitate to get a hold of me. You can find us in iTunes, Microsoft, Zoom, and a host of other places around on the net. And if you have questions, especially about how to do the podcast on your smartphone, please don't hesitate to send me an email. I'll do my very, very best to help you out on that. Also, just real quickly, the Space Show is brought to you in part by the Secure World Foundation. Secure World promotes cooperative solutions for space security. For more information, visit their own website, swfound.org. Secure World also is the sponsor of our webinar series. Our next one is Monday afternoon, California time, 5 p.m., 7 p.m., and it's going to talk about using space resources to mitigate Earth disasters in weather and, other kinds of things, earthquakes, etc. We almost had to use them last Sunday in California, but fortunately it wasn't that bad. But anyway, that's going to be Monday afternoon on September 22nd, and the details will shortly be published on the website newsletter under Coming Attractions. Everything else you can get from our website. I want to move on and tell you about our guest today so we have the maximum time possible in talking with Mike Simmons. Mr. Simmons has been an amateur astronomer for 40 years, and he loves sharing the sky with others. He joined the Los Angeles Astronomical Society in the early 70s and served in many capacities, including 2 terms as president and 10 years on the board of directors. In 1976, he joined the staff of the Griffith Observatory, which is in L.A., and you all should be familiar with that. We've done many programs about the Griffith Observatory and with people there. And while he was there, he operated the Zeiss 12-inch refracting telescope for the public, and he described the many facets of astronomy to thousands and thousands of visitors. In the early 1980s, Mike was instrumental in founding the Mount Wilson Observatory Association. This is a support organization dedicated to improving the experience of visitors who go to visit the very, very famous Mount Wilson Observatory. His outreach efforts in astronomy broadened in 1999, and he then traveled to Iran for a total solar eclipse. in Iran, he found an enthusiastic astronomy community lacking the resources that are available here in the West. He has since been to Iran several times, and in 2004, he led a group of Westerners to Iran to observe the rare transit of Venus, alongside hundreds of Iranian amateur astronomers. In 2006, he also traveled to the Kurdistan region of northern Iraq, and he brought observing equipment, and which was donated by American astronomers, to them, and they were also very enthusiastic about astronomy. He's assisted amateur astronomers and educators in many other countries via the internet. Seeing astronomy as a universal interest that transcends cultural differences, Mike founded Astronomers Without Borders in the year 2006, and he now serves as the president of this effort to unite astronomy and space enthusiasts around the world. He has also had a minor planet named in his honor in 2003, Minor Planet Simmons, and this is in part an honor for his outreach activities in astronomy. His full bio is on the Space Show newsletter website. It will be, of course, on the Space Show when we archive this program. I would urge you to visit their website, which is astronomerswithoutborders.org. That's all one word, .org. And Mike, welcome to the Space Show. It's nice to talk to you and to learn about Astronomers Without Borders.
Well, thanks very much for inviting me, David.
One real quick question. Alan Hale is a great friend of mine and has been on the show many times, and I know he's been to Iran. Is he part of the same group with you?
Well, he's not really. I know Alan as well, and he started his own Earthrise Foundation. It was just a coincidence that we both had visited Iran at the same time for the same eclipse in 99. He took a group then, and I think he might have been back once. I've been back quite a few times. But so we cooperate, and we know each other, but it's a separate effort.
Yes. Do you feel safe when you go to Iran?
I feel very safe in Iran. It's you know, there's no, as far as crime, it's pretty low. And as far as being an American, and this is one of the things that that sort of led to Astronomers Without Borders, is the reality is very much different than people expect. It's perhaps the most pro-American country I've ever been to. So you're very much welcome there.
Interesting. Tell us about Astronomers Without Borders. You actually went to Iran before you ever formed it, right?
Right. Well, it was visits to Iran and Iraq, and realizing that the reality that there was very different than I expected, and that other people expected, led me to this. Because when I came back, I wrote some magazine articles and gave a lot of presentations on astronomy in Iran. And it turned into more of a cultural education. People were fascinated learning about the country. And what made it possible and what gave the start to it was this common interest and the same activity. So they were interested in what people were doing in this relatively unknown country for Americans. But it turned out, you know, really they're doing exactly the same thing, and they're so much the activities, the behaviors, the interests we share in common. And so by personalizing it that way, people wanted to know more about the country and what the people are like, and they were more sympathetic towards the people there who couldn't get telescopes and things like that. So it worked so well to sort of connect people together that I thought we needed to expand it to really all the countries.
What is their astronomy IQ like? Are they well-informed on astronomy and space matters? Is it a big part of their culture?
Well, it actually is, and every culture is different, and this is one of the fascinating things, is that astronomy, the thing is, it's a part of every culture. It's in every culture throughout time in many different ways, and in Iran, they're very oriented towards science. The population is extremely young. About two-thirds of the population is under the age of 30. They're very well educated, and it's extremely active as far as astronomy goes, because, you know, astronomy is one of the few sciences where there are so many amateurs. People get involved in it. you don't need some special laboratory or equipment. The sky is above you. It's all there, and it's a part of our environment. So they are actually quite active and very involved. And in fact, one of the people on our Board of Trustees is Anusha Ansari, who you'll know and your listeners will know, of course, as a co-sponsor of the Ansari X Prize. But she was the first Iranian to go into space as well as a private space explorer, spending 10 days on the ISS. This is a gigantic thing in Iran. So they're very much forward-looking as far as space and astronomy.
Yes, she was on the space show shortly after her return.
Oh.
And I haven't seen her for a while, but that was a big thing, especially since she was a woman also, not just that she was the first Iranian.
Right, right.
I mean, it was a big deal. So how do you choose a country to go to with Astronomers Without Borders?
Well, the thing is that the Astronomers Without Borders is really a grassroots organization, and we have a community of people that are members or participants in our programs all over the world. So we can't do that much in the physical world of people traveling back and forth to meet each other. I have the opportunity to do that with some very interesting countries where I might be invited or have a conference or something. But for the most part, it's online, and the website actually is undergoing a transformation right now, but we're going to bring back and enhance some of the things. The interaction is online. The programs that we do, everybody in the world can take part in, and most of the world's countries do, but it's individuals doing their own thing, and we can share with each other online about what we're doing. And sometimes even live interactions online. But for the most part, you know, it's just too expensive for people to go back and forth.
So I'm on your website now. So I guess if you sign up for some kind of an account, that enables you to communicate with people around the world who have a similar interest?
Well, we have, you know, the membership is free if you so choose, because otherwise most of the world wouldn't be able to participate. And it's the community is really the product. And we do have, of course, and encourage people to take paid memberships to help support what it is we do. But right now you get the newsletter, you learn about the programs going on. There are new programs that are starting that will be connecting people together. And like I said, it's a little bit sparse on some of the ways in which people can share, but every member gets the opportunity to have a blog of their own where they can report what they or their amateur astronomy club is doing, and others can read those and comment, post pictures, and we'll be bringing back a forum soon as well. So there are a number of ways that people can be a part of the community of people who are passionate about the sky.
So when there are, for example, total eclipses or something really unique happening, do you try to go to that country where you can see it best and like run a tour for members?
Well, I do try to go to total eclipses as often as I can, which, again, since it involves, you know, expensive travel, I can't always do that. I've been to 7 total solar eclipses, including the one in Iran in 1999. I have participated in tours once or twice where I've been one of the leaders of a tour for a company. Usually I go myself, but astrotourism is a term that your listeners might not have heard, and this is about things such as what we did for the Venus transit, where the best spot really to me in the world was in southern Iran to observe it, and eclipses, but also people, for example, in Europe will travel during their winter or other times when it's cloudy or they don't have access to dark skies, will go to Africa or Asia or other places. And this is it's like going on safari to Africa. It's the thing that may draw you there, but it's not the only thing you do. But it's just one of the activities. And that's something that we've been talking to different people in different countries for quite some time and would like to do. But again, that'll involve a small percentage of the population who can afford to do that.
Now, you contacted me, and you mentioned a program called the Monthly Hangout. What is that all about?
Yeah. Well, we do have a Google Plus Hangout every month, just to bring people up to date on what's going on and have some guests sometimes from different places around the world who are participating in our programs, whatever it is that's most often going on. So that's a monthly thing that we do, and we have guests from various places, and once in a while we'll have a special one. And it's similar to what you're doing, but it happens to be on a different platform with the video, which is problematic, of course, when we have somebody come in from Nigeria or someplace else with less bandwidth.
It's just a discussion forum. Is that
yeah.
Now, to be able to participate in that, you need to be a member and sign up for this?
Well, we have a few different guests that we invite, and those are open to anybody. And in fact, they're all archived on YouTube too. So if you go to YouTube and look for Astronomers Without Borders, you can see some of the programs that we've done. Sometimes there's something special. In 2012, we had a webcast from Mount Wilson Observatory with a group of observers from the Antique Telescope Society using historic instruments to observe that very rare event. That was the second one to happen during our lifetimes and the last until the 22nd century. So, or late into the 21st, I guess. So, anyway, so we do something special once in a while as well. And really, we try to make it as open as possible for everybody, but to be able to share things, to have something of your own on our website for others to take part in, that does require an account to be a member. Like I said, there are more things coming up as well.
I have an email from Joe, who is in Portland, Oregon, and he said, is there an age that is more or less appropriate on the lower side? I have kids that are in grade school and about to start middle school, and they do like to look through telescopes. What do you think is the best age for introducing them to something like this?
You know, that's an interesting question, and there are a lot of answers, but I think basically the most common answer, the consensus you would get from most people is as soon as they're interested, which is, you know, the earlier the better. Kids have a fascination with astronomy. In all the outreach I've done, you know, quite often it's families coming to look through a telescope, and this is for the kids because they're just fascinated about it. But the truth is, once an adult looks through a telescope for the first time at the moon or at Saturn with its rings or something, everybody kind of reverts back to being kids. It's almost something primal. It's so fascinating. But as far as when to start, there are even actually programs developed for introducing pre-grade school children in nursery schools and things, and in the earliest years to astronomy. It's called the Universe Awareness, and there might be some things on that website Joe would be interested in. I know of kids that are very young that operate their own telescopes. I can mention that we have one that's a great beginner scope and is frequently used for kids also that we sell in the store. It's part of our fundraising, and it supports what we do. And I know of kids as young as 8 who do that, and somebody just purchased one for a 3-year-old, which I think is a little too young to actually operate it. But like I say, as soon as they're interested, why not?
So the telescope you're talking about is the One Sky Telescope for $200? Is that what
you're saying? That's it. Yeah, exactly. And it's only available in the U.S. because it is available from other companies as a similar model in other countries. But we're supported by Celestron, which is the world's largest manufacturer of telescopes, and they do all the work of importing it. They even front the money and everything, and so that it's branded for us. And they do that as a way of supporting what we do, as creating an income stream. And it's extremely popular, so we kind of undersell people in other countries where it's sold. So we agreed to keep it to our own country here.
So what is this telescope? Can you say something about it?
Sure. Well, there's a very there are two types of telescopes, refracting telescopes and reflecting telescopes. So the refractor is the typical spyglass type. You know, you look through one end and there's a lens on the other end. The reflecting type was first invented by Isaac Newton, so it's quite old design, but it's become far more popular in many ways in modern times. So this is a reflecting type telescope, which allows you really to economically make a little bit larger telescopes than the refractors. It's also collapsible, and it's what's called the Dobsonian design, which is a very, very simple design. No computers, nothing. You just push it around, and it's a tabletop. It sits on top of something, or I guess if it's younger kids, you can put it down lower. So it's a very easy and transportable one.
Is it very powerful?
It's got a mirror a little over 5 inches across. That determines the light-gathering power. In a dark sky, you can see lots of deep-sky objects, planetary nebula and other nebulas and star clusters in some galaxies. You don't usually try to increase the magnification on telescopes too much. You can do that to any amount you want in any telescope, but we're kind of limited by the Earth's atmosphere, and you know, some of these things are really huge, so this is actually a good one for sort of scanning the sky, finding things, and then zooming in a little bit.
So you mentioned Celestron, so I know people who buy these Celestrons, also Meads, that are connected to their computers and things like that, and they never can figure out how to work them, so of course they never use them. You've probably heard this story before. Do you run classes? Do you teach people how to use the more sophisticated telescopes?
I've done that individually. We don't do that as an organization. There are lots of organizations that do this kind of thing to help people out, and most importantly, astronomy clubs. And this is a common problem with the go-to computerized telescopes. You have to figure out how to use it. The problem with you don't have that is you have to learn the sky. Some of us favor just learning the sky and not. It's like going to a new city. If you know where the layout of the city and you don't have to depend on GPS, you really can't get lost. But then, you know, the GPS you have to depend on. So the very best for anybody that's interested, if they have a telescope, don't have a telescope, is to find the nearest local amateur astronomy club and contact them. People love to share what it is they're doing. They love to help you out. And they often have clinics for people to get new telescopes for Christmas, for example, to help them out and get them started so the telescopes don't end up just sitting.
Wanda in Denver says, do you help people that are underprivileged in the United States get telescopes?
Well, that's interesting. First of all, I want to mention that everything we do is really pretty much global, and I don't repeat things that other people are doing, and there are efforts in the U.S. to do this. We do have programs that are helping people in some underdeveloped countries. A big one right now in Tanzania that's probably going to make a big difference. It's really about science education, not just getting telescopes. We do not have a program. There are so many things we could do. It costs. We don't have a program for that in particular in the United States. I believe there are some others that do. I know programs that do donate telescopes to libraries. And usually the focus on things like this is schools because you have the biggest impact there. But we ourselves don't have that in the country right now, no.
Another one for you is John, and John is in, he says, just Orange County, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And he says, is it still possible to do tours to Mount Wilson as well as Mount Palomar? I've always wanted to take my kids there, but I thought that for some reason they were closed off to tours.
Yeah, well, you know, the professional observatories, they usually care a lot about the outreach and visiting people visiting the observatory, but it's an extra thing that they have to do. Mount Wilson, I can say for sure that right now, and it may end on October 1st, it's closed for the winter completely to the public. But during the summer, the warmer months, beginning, I believe it's April through September, and I'm not sure about October now. There are public tours on the weekends at 1 and 2 o'clock both, I believe. And those are really good tours. You go inside the 100-inch telescope and see a lot of things. So you can visit there, and I recommend going on a weekend or holiday when there's a tour. For Mount Wilson, check the website at mtwilson.edu, like Mount Wilson. Now, Palomar, I know that they also have docents there, but I don't know the particulars of the visiting. I'm sure that it is open to the public, and I'm not sure if they have tours there or not.
Do they still use Mount Wilson and Palomar for professional observatory, or has light pollution taken them down?
Light pollution does make a big difference. There are other things as well. Palomar, the 200-inch telescope, is always used, and they have some other telescopes there as well that are not as well known, and they are working pretty much all the time. That's run by Caltech. So there is research going on there. The light pollution is not that bad. Mount Wilson, the light pollution is very bad, but there are different things that can be done at these observatories that aren't affected as much by the light pollution. For example, Mount Wilson has the world's largest interferometer for visual work, a special kind of array of telescopes. And they work quite often in the infrared, and they're not affected by the light pollution from the city right below, which is pretty intense. The larger telescopes are not in use for the most part now, but mostly because there isn't funding to use them. And a 100-inch telescope these days is considered a small telescope. But this is kind of a plus for the public, and I recommend this highly. Anybody that wants to get a group together, you can rent out the 60-inch telescope for visual observing. So this is a massive telescope. It one time was the largest telescope in the world. I'd recommend that. It's a great experience, and the 100-inch telescope is being outfitted to do the same thing.
So you can actually rent it out, and then someone is there, and they let everyone who's coming use the 60-inch for visual observatory?
Yeah, that's exactly right. There's an operator there to operate the telescope, and there is a session director there to work with the people and sort of handle logistics. There's a maximum of 25 visitors in the dome. I think it's about $900 for a half night and $1,700 for a full night. Well worth it, you know, divided up in a group, or sometimes people just do it themselves because then they can spend more time at the eyepiece. And, yeah, that's exactly what it's for, and it's a great experience.
Well, you hope that the night you select has a clear sky.
You can only hope, you know, and, of course, you're not stuck for it if it's completely clouded out, if it's canceled ahead of time, and, you know, and there are other rules if you get part of the night and then it clouds up or something, and you know, those are best checked on the website there.
This is a question from June, and June is in Flagstaff, Arizona. And June says, talking specifically about Astronomers Without Borders, what do you find to be the most interesting? Is it the travel? Is it talking to people in other countries about astronomy and showing them things? What do you actually like the best about the work of Astronomers Without Borders?
Well, what I like the most really is the fact that we have a community of people that participate, everybody doing things together. Some of the programs we have, for example, you mentioned an eclipse. So if there's something special going on in the sky, we know everybody around the world is looking at an eclipse. Of course, a total eclipse is different. It's only in a very narrow band of a very narrow path. But the eclipse can be seen at least partially in a very large area, and we know people are observing it from all over. So we can have people who are essentially doing this together in different parts of the world. We're looking at the same thing, we're doing the same thing, and we can share. What is most satisfying to me is the fact that people in many countries are somewhat isolated and, you know, may have very few amateur astronomers and no telescopes. But this way they're connected with the rest of the world, with American astronomers, with people in Europe and so on. And this is really, it's hard for us here to understand, but in a lot of countries where they don't have the opportunities we do, this is really a big deal. And I hear from people that say, you know, I participate in the programs and how great it is. I've never heard of them. Or I don't know what it is they're doing. So that personally is the most satisfying. Now, for me, I'd love to be able to travel and go visit other cultures. Astronomy is the thing that brings us together. But like I said, it's learning about each other and finding out how similar we are, and occasionally a difference that that I love doing, but most of the time, you know, I'm at the computer helping organize projects.
Craig is in Houston, and he says, I see you have Beam Me to Mars by Owingu on the website. David recently had Alan Stern back on, who was talking about the program. Are you officially part of the Owingu program, or is this just supporting the program?
We're as much of a part of it as we could be, I guess. We wouldn't be called a partner, but Astronomers Without Borders supports what Owingu is doing, and they support us. We have been a grantee. We've received support from them, from their programs. Beam Me to Mars is similar. If you look on their page there, you'll see that we're listed there as endorsers of it. So we're pretty much connected in many ways. And in fact, even with the Mars crater naming, where Owingu has its own map that's being that people can name their craters on, we have a province there that we'd like people to name craters within that. So we're pretty well connected, but they do an awful lot of great stuff, I think, to bring the people in and to fund worthwhile organizations, and we've been a beneficiary of that.
And you also have your own Indiegogo program that you mentioned to me, right?
Well, this is another type of project that we have does involve helping people in other countries. This is a great project that was started by a couple of people who had visited Tanzania as a part of they were retired Lutheran pastors, and they went with the church group that was doing support. But they happen to be amateur astronomers as well, and they started their own program, which has come under Astronomers Without Borders as it grew. Telescopes to Tanzania has trained teachers in Tanzania, has provided some telescopes and other things, but this project is really the next big step, and this is the kind of thing that we'd like to do more of, that we can really make a difference. And that is that they have trained teachers from around the country. They've established all the stakeholders there, gotten the government involved, and this project is for a center for science, which is not just the building and observatory, which is a part of it, but also the center, the office, and curriculum building. There have been workshops. The point of this is that astronomy, I call it a gateway science, you know. There is science lacking in many countries, and we'd like to see more of it in the U.S. as well. Astronomy is almost cost-free. The sky is there for everybody, and ironically, in developing countries, it's darker because they have fewer lights, and they've got an even better sky. And this is a way to introduce science education to schools. So what this is doing in Tanzania is not just providing some resources, but actually training teachers, sending staff out to teach how to do inquiry-based, hands-on science learning using the resources available. You don't need a chem lab. You don't need a nuclear reactor. You don't need anything. The sky is there. Provide a few telescopes and the resources. And so this is a sort of a homegrown project that's been expedited. And so the project there is to raise funds for that particular project.
And listeners, if you're interested, excuse me, it's on your website, correct?
It's on the website, front and center, a little rotating slide thing there about the latest things. And
yeah, it says 8 more days to Telescopes to Tanzania campaign. Is that it?
That's it, yeah. Yeah, so people can, and this is really another whole category that we do as well. Last year, there was a total solar eclipse that goes across, that went across Africa, and so some of the lucky ones got to be in that path of totality, but most of the continent saw at least a partial eclipse, and this is an opportunity for nature, for science, for science education, for millions of kids and adults. And so we had a fundraising project to have people buy the solar eclipse glasses, which we also sell to raise funds. And they would buy them at the minimum price, and we shipped them over to Africa to have them distributed to schools all across the continent. We had many thousands that were done that way. So sharing our resources, we share the sky when we observe together, but we want to share resources as well. And that goes both ways. We learn so much from seeing what happens in other countries and different cultures. But, you know, we have more wealth here, and buying a few solar glasses, you know, with everybody working together really adds up, and it makes a difference.
Carrie is in Tucson. He says, what is a night sky umbrella?
Oh, well, is he looking at our website? We have an umbrella there.
Yeah, he must be, because I'm looking at the website. I was looking for the glasses that you were talking about.
Yeah,
I also see a night sky umbrella, and I'm wondering, what the heck is a night sky umbrella?
Okay, well, hopefully there's a picture there that people can see. This is actually pretty, and I've seen a few different versions of this, but this is the best one I've seen. These were donated by a company that supports us. Actually, the owner is also on our board, which is CanadianTelescopes.com, for those who are in Canada. And this is an umbrella. When you open it up, it has the stars and constellations marked on there, even some of the dark sky objects, the brighter ones, some that you might see with the naked eye. So it's just a very cool thing. It's a fairly large umbrella, and it's just neat for the astronomy enthusiast.
So it's just an umbrella that has the sky on the inside
exactly,
of it.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah.
And that, I take it that's the Northern Hemisphere sky, right?
It is the Northern Hemisphere. I don't remember what latitude it's sort of set for, but it does matter what your latitude is. But, you know, if it's raining, that's one way to still see the sky, I guess. Huh?
Absolutely. I think that's really cool.
It is. Pretty neat. Yeah.
And it's a large umbrella. It's not any more costly than buying a large umbrella in the store.
Right.
Hopefully it will last more than one rainstorm.
Yeah, it's reasonably so. I have a few of those, actually. This is the best one I've seen.
Very, very cool. What are some of the other projects that you're currently undertaking and involved in?
Well, one thing that we're just opening up in a broader sense, and for those listeners who are in astronomy clubs in the U.S. or Canada, or in a developing country someplace else, we are pairing clubs up. Now, this is a more direct Astronomers Without Borders type of a program, really goes to the heart of it. So we have, you know, I've talked to astronomy clubs, and they say that's neat, they're interested in the other clubs. This actually connects them up for live contact. It's sort of like having a pen pal in the old days, but now you can Skype, and if the bandwidth is good enough on both ends, you can have some video and talk to each other. We actually plan to eventually use some online telescopes that can be controlled remotely so that U.S. clubs, if they have astrophotographers and others, or people that are particularly good at outreach, they can mentor the clubs in the developing countries that haven't had an opportunity to learn as much or have these possibilities. And that's a larger program, too. Not only will we share our resources in terms of the knowledge and the experience, but we have those online resources thanks to another partner, Las Cumbres Observatory Global Telescope Network. And then we will also be partnering, once this gets going, with Universe Awareness and another program called Galileo Teacher Training Program, which trains teachers around the world to teach astronomy, again, as a way to get into science, and have the clubs go into the classrooms, and they can use the remote telescopes from there as well. So this sort of covers a lot of the different kinds of territory. There's a direct interaction with small numbers, but big impact in both sides when they do outreach.
Do you go into other nations? Do you go to China, for example? Is there an interest in China for this?
You know, there is. I've been to China several times, mostly for meetings. There's one project in particular that's going on there that I'm involved in, which has to do with preserving the dark skies that they have. And this will be a project in Tibet. And there is a great deal of interest, and there's a great deal of activity. China is one of those countries that until recently sort of kept to themselves. And they didn't participate that much in the types of things that we're doing. But that's changed a lot in the last few years, and they're very much more interested now in connecting with people in other countries, with people in the West. And so there is more connection happening now. And we've seen lots of participation in the past, too. See, every April we have Global Astronomy Month, and this is a celebration of astronomy in all its types. And we've always had participation from them. This is local events that everybody does essentially the same thing, but it's a platform for them to do it and share with others and know they're doing it with others at the same time. So there may not be direct interaction between people, but it's like instead of having a local star party where amateur astronomers take their telescopes out, it's a huge one around the world, and everybody's doing it together.
This is a question for you from Paul in New York City. And Paul says, David, thank you for doing this show and bringing this organization to our attention. Mike, most of the people, in my opinion, who listen to the Space Show are really interested in space development, human space flight, space exploration, space science, and subjects like that. How do you connect the dots with astronomy and learning astronomy to space development, space exploration, human space flight, wanting to go to Mars, have a Martian settlement or a lunar settlement? Can you help us connect the dots to astronomy to that?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question and a great topic, and I'd love to talk about that a little. I'll tell you first off, it's interesting that in other countries they don't make a distinction between space exploration and astronomy the same way we do here. And I figure, well, that's because most countries, they aren't doing space exploration themselves. They always follow what NASA is doing and everything. But that distinction, too, is not made by some very interesting people. For example, astronauts. You know, I've known several astronauts, and quite often their inspiration is really astronomy. They start getting interested in the sky, and really, if we weren't able to see the sky, how many people would be interested in space exploration in the same way? If you didn't see the stars, if you didn't see the planets crossing the sky, there really isn't a distinction between them. We're sort of looking at it from two perspectives. One other organization, which is the only one I can afford to spend more time on, but is so good, is called the Overview Institute. This was started by Frank White, the author of The Overview Effect, that probably many of your listeners are aware of.
Yeah, he's been on the show several times. We're real familiar with Frank, and he's a good friend
and
the Institute.
So he formed this with some others, and I'm part of the initial group with that. And I have blogged on Ron Guerin and Nicole Stotz, two astronauts, Fragile Oasis website, for example, and I talked to Frank and some others. And to me, astronomy is the overview effect for the rest of us. So I'm 64 years old now. I'm probably not going to make it into space myself. But when we look at the sky, and especially when we understand that it isn't our sky, it's everybody's sky, and you know that somebody else on the other side of the planet is looking out, but in a different direction, it really gives a sense that we are in space. This is the overview effect. It requires a little knowledge and a little bit of information. But when you look up there, it's the same idea. So, you know, one of the things, I believe it's Frank who actually will sometimes ask an audience where he's giving a presentation. He did this once at the NSS meeting. How many of you would like to go to space? Everybody raised their hands. He said, well, congratulations, you made it. You know, we are in space.
We are in space, right, of course.
And astronomy brings that home to the rest of us and shows us how we are all together on one planet. And when the U.S. or Europe goes to another planet, everybody feels like this is humanity doing it.
So you don't see a big difference in people focused on pushing for Mars settlements or going to live on Mars or getting people to Mars, is that different from astronomy in general?
It's not really. You know, most of us are going to look at Mars through telescopes or see it. You know, this last night I was out late, as I usually am, noticed Mars going down along with Saturn, and that's another planet. Well, I'm not going to be the ones making that settlement. I'm excited and follow the robotic missions, hope to see humans on Mars in my lifetime. But for me, I can still look across there and see the planet. And if I had a chance to go and come back, I have to add, then of course I would do it. But I'm not going to be able to do that. So that's the participation I have. I just don't see a distinction.
This is really interesting because I like to ask a lot of guests, how did you get your interest in space development or space exploration? And, you know, most of them will say very early as a kid, you know, I got a telescope or I was always looking up at the night sky or something. They don't say astronomy interested me, you know, unless they become an astronomer. They never say I got my interest through astronomy, but actually that's the foundation because they looked up and they really got thrilled about what they see and they wanted to go there or do work there or, you know, whatever their passion might be. But you're right, it all comes through astronomy.
Yeah, absolutely, and it's not even necessary to say it's astronomy. Just it's the night sky, it's the stars, it's the planets, it's looking through a telescope. But, you know, how many people would say they have an interest in botany? You know, I mean, you see plants, and if you're interested in that, you might learn about them. You don't say, well, I'm a botanist, or you don't say, I'm doing botany because I'm
No, you
identified.
You might say, I like to garden and tinker in my garden or something like that.
Exactly. These are just different manifestations of the same thing. And, you know, the labels are just, there's one thing that we start with, just like your guests who say, I looked through a telescope, I looked at the stars. There we start. Then we diverge in our paths. Some of us go deeper into the astronomy aspect, viewing from here, using large telescopes and things like that. And others go into actually working on the craft or becoming one of the people who goes up there. So, but I can tell you, you know, people who make it to low Earth orbit in the International Space Station, that's not the end of their interest in space. You know, we can't explore as far as we can see.
No, that's just the beginning. Most of them want to do a lot more.
Sure, that means astronomy. So, you know, there just isn't a dividing line. It's just different manifestations of the same interest, the same drive we have. The sky is half of our environment, which people don't notice as much now. This is why it's so important to try and preserve dark skies and to get them back, which is a very simple thing to do in the long run, because, you know, it's still there. Light pollution is completely reversible. You just stop pointing lights up and keep it down on the ground. You save money. It's, you know, you can still see the stars. That's half of our environment, but the fact is that the rest of the universe is 99.99 odd infinitum percent of our environment. We are out there in space, and the universe is where we are.
Jake is in San Diego, and Jake said, David, I can't call in. I'm listening on my smartphone. So here is my email question for your guest. I'm a high school student. I'm not playing hooky, by the way. My school doesn't start until after Labor Day. But is there an amateur radio telescope or astronomy organization or hardware for people that are interested in radio telescopes and radio astronomy? Is there anything on the amateur level for that?
Yes, there is. That's great, and this is a wonderful question and wonderful interest too, because with radio, you're not even limited to the nighttime, and you don't worry about light pollution, though you do have to worry about radio interference. So, and I'm afraid I don't have enough specifics. There is a radio amateur society of some sort in the U.S., and there are many different types of simple antennas that people can build, and I've seen them in you know, developing countries. They find some wood that they nail together, and they have some wires. These are very simple. It's sort of an elaborate version or larger version or more finely tuned version of an old TV antenna. It's a simple thing to do. I don't have the specifics. You know, I might have answered it, but I can't recall exactly where to go. But if he's interested and wants to write to me, you know, I can ask some people. But probably a Google search will find quite a bit on that as well. But he's more than welcome to write to me, and I'll get some answers for him.
You have a contact link on your website. Does that get to you?
That gets to me, yeah. There's one that's specifically for me, or it's so public it doesn't matter. My direct address is Mike S., so that's M like Michael, I-K-E, S like Sam, at astronomerswithoutborders.org.
Okay. Where you live, which is in the northern part of Los Angeles, is light pollution a big issue?
Well, anywhere around Los Angeles, light pollution is a big issue. In the city itself, it's really quite bad. But I'm lucky enough to live outside the city in an unincorporated area, in a very rural area in the Santa Monica Mountains, with some hills that block much of the light. And, when I was out last night, for example, I could barely detect the Milky Way. That's good, but frankly, it's not good enough because very few people now grow up in an area or visit an area that's really dark and don't understand what it is that they're missing. The sky has been a part of our culture for as long as humans have been around, but it's only in the last 100 years that we've had artificial lights that have kind of wiped that out. And people don't understand. We have one project under us, The World at Night, which is a group of the best landscape astrophotographers. They take wide-field images, sometimes panoramas, even 360 degrees, of the sky with important or interesting natural or historic or cultural landscape in the foreground. And I've had questions, why do you show the sky like that? It doesn't look like that with all those stars and with the Milky Way. Well, people don't realize. So this is something we've cut ourselves off from entirely. Most people grow up in cities now, and they're kind of shocked when they see what they've been missing. You go out into a dark place. I'd urge everybody to do that and just at least understand what's there. It's like going to a forest if you've never seen a tree before.
I've done lots of shows with people in Flagstaff and from around the country with dark skies organizations and the International Dark Skies Organization.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it just seems like progress is really, really hard to make in getting communities to not just code for new lighting that is dark skies, but to, you know, mandate some changes when you renovate things. But
yeah.
Here in the Bay Area, I'm up in Northern California and San Francisco, we're totally wiped out.
Yeah.
You know, it's probably like being, you know, in the valley in L.A. or something. But I have been in the desert of Tucson and Montana and Wyoming and places, and it's not even like you're on the same planet. I mean,
absolutely.
And it's really a shame.
And that's when you really get a sense that you are, like you say, not even on the same planet. I mean, if you'd be in any planet in the solar system, this is what you would see. That's when you really get a sense of that. And what's really a shame is this is easy. And actually, doing the solutions save everybody money. I mean, there's no reason not to do it. There's also more evidence now about light at night being harmful to people as well as the ecology. But all you have to do is make sure whatever light you're using, you point it downwards and you don't let it go up. Because the analogy is having lawn sprinklers. You know, if it's pouring under your driveway over the edge of the lawn, you would fix that. You don't want to throw the water away. Why are
absolutely.
We spending money on energy to send light into space?
Absolutely. I'm seeing now that the codes are coming out for special kind of lighting that is cheaper to operate. And as part of making it cheaper to operate, they're changing the way that light gets dispersed into the atmosphere, and they're changing some of the focal forces of where that light is going to go. So in a sense, to save energy on electrical bills and to save fuel and things like that, and to lower the cost of lighting, which is here in California, as you know, electricity is really costly.
Right.
They're sort of accomplishing dark skies, but not because they want to accomplish dark skies, because they want to have more effective and more efficient night lighting.
Right,
and they run hand in hand.
They do. It's the light pollution is just wasted energy. And, you know, someone who says, well, you know, don't tell me I have to change my lights. Well, I mean, there is an initial cost, but you're just throwing it away in the meantime. If you have a globe of light, half of it's going into the sky. So, yeah, in the long run, that may be the saving grace, but there are a lot of good reasons for it.
Yeah, and you know, people, if you go out in your front yard with your kids or your backyard and you have outdoor lighting and you put your telescope out there, seriously, your outdoor lighting at the front of your house or on your deck or your patio or your backyard can screw up your observing. Just that much wasted light. So it doesn't take too much to do a research. Go look up dark skies, and you'll find all sorts of residential and affordable outdoor lighting that will give you plenty of light, but is also dark skies compatible, and that would absolutely change your telescope viewing in your backyard or the front of your house.
Or even the naked eye or binocular viewing as well. And I'd also tell people, you know, take your kids out. You may have missed this as a kid. Don't let your own kids miss it. Go out to a dark place. And the thing is that there are people who go out to a dark place, but of course they're inside the whole time at night. Go to a dark place. Go out at night. Give your eyes a few seconds to adjust, and you'll be astonished that there is nothing more magnificent. But it's something that we're missing.
Absolutely. I grew up in the late 40s and the 50s in Tulsa, so we had dark skies. We didn't know about it, and then light just gradually creeps in even there and every place else. And until you go to some place like Montana or the deserts in Tucson or New Mexico or something, you really don't know what you're missing.
Absolutely. Well, you know, but most people don't go outside at night now anyway. They don't realize there might be a reason to.
No, and you know, when they have these great telescopic events and eclipses and things, and I send out newsletters to people to go look at it and, you know, what part of the country they're in, you know what they tell me? I'm not going to bother. I can look at it on the Internet.
Yeah, people, first of all, seeing stars for real is, well, I mean, that's like saying, you give somebody a ticket to Paris, I'm not going to bother because I can look at pictures of it. It's not the same thing, and it's that much of a difference. I can tell you, it's interesting. I was in an event with a lot of astronomers and other people recently, and one of the people there was a well-known Harvard professor, and, you know, she said, I haven't really looked through telescopes much. The other was a well-known cosmologist. He's an amateur astronomer, and he's kind of a famous guy, Alex Filipenko, who's done a lot of stuff. And he was operating the telescope. You know, I didn't have to do it. And the Harvard professor said, I've never really looked through telescopes much, that most professional astronomers do. And she looked through the telescope at Saturn, and she was just kind of floored.
Blown away.
Yeah, and it's not... You know, it's just one of those things you don't know until you see it. Putting your eye up to the glass is quite a different experience.
Mike, we're pretty much at the end of the hour. What should I have asked you, or what did you want to talk about or bring to our attention that maybe we've omitted or forgotten about?
Well, let's see. We do a lot of different types of programs. Astronomy crosses all borders geologically too, politically, religiously. You know, it's something that's a part of everything. But that doesn't just apply to those things. We have a growing and really fascinating astro arts program. This was started by an artist who is involved with some radio amateurs who send images to the moon. They're reflected off and picked up here, but she involves it in her own performances. So there are all these great space artists. Some of them are artists interested in space. Some of them are actually astronomers who do art. There's a blog. There's one of the things we just on the program we just had was our astro crafts person. So we cross borders in a lot of different ways. There's a lot of astro poetry, which to me was Robert Frost. I know some of those things, but there are a lot of people doing it. So that's another type of program we have. There are just so many opportunities to do different things in education and arts and many things. So that's another big class.
Are these on your website someplace?
They are on the website, and we...
Where would I look?
Well, you know, for projects on the home page, you scroll down just a little bit, and there are several different types of programs there.
Okay.
And you can click on one of those and click on the Learn More button, and it'll take you to those.
Okay. Okay, any, you probably just gave a good summary, but any specific summary or talking points or takeaways you want our listeners to know today?
Well, not really. I guess the main idea that astronomy is something that everybody's involved in, whether they know it or not, and including the people who, as we discussed, who are listening, who are into space exploration. It's all about our place in the universe. Astronomy does give us a sense of where we are, which is the impetus for learning more, looking at it, or going there. And that's what we're really about. All the programs are global, accessible to everyone. Accessibility is another thing. We have programs also for the disabled, even astronomy for the blind, which is based on touch or some things that people can't see. So it really is something universal. It seems to be a part of us all. It's like it's part of our genes.
Well, listen, it's great to meet you and to find out more about this organization. I'm sure we'll be talking to you more down the road as you have other projects you want to bring to our attention and other developments. So just let me know, and we'll do some more programming with you.
I would love to, David, and I really enjoyed it. You got a great audience with good questions.
Thank you very much. Have a good Labor Day holiday, okay?
Thanks very much.
And again, listeners, that's it for today. And Sunday we have our show with Dr. Bill Rowe. No show Monday because of the holiday, and then look at the newsletters for starting again up on Tuesday. Everybody have a great weekend. Keep it safe. Enjoy your times with your family or your friends, and talk to you again on Sunday. Goodbye from the Space Show.